I call Senate Resources to order for the 29th Legislature. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to all of you here in the room, and welcome to everyone viewing online. So to start the committee out today, I'm going to introduce committee members, and then we'll also introduce staff and talk about the goals for the committee going forward before we get into the presentation today. So beginning here on my right, we have Senator John Coghill, who comes from my birthplace, Fairbanks. Welcome, Senator Coghill. He's certainly worked hard in the legislature, both the House and Senate, for many years, and so I'm really pleased that you're joining us on the committee. On my left side is Senator Peter Michicki, who is actually now serving my previous district, the Kenai. So welcome, Senator Michicki. And your staff member, Larry Simmons, was going to be here also, may be here with us. And so welcome. You certainly have a background in oil and gas, mainly gas, of course, and commercial fishing. So I know you'll bring a lot of good information to the committee. Next to him, Senator Bert Stedman, member of the committee representing Sitka and Southeast Alaska. Your committee member, or your committee aide, Randy Rao, is here. This is certainly not a new committee to you, Senator Stedman, so welcome. I know you've done a great deal on Energy Council, chairing that organization for quite a while. We have two freshman senators on the committee as well. Senator Mia Costello is here, so welcome, Senator Costello. She is the committee vice chair, so thank you for doing that. She has worked hard over in the other body and working hard for her district, so I know you'll contribute a lot here. Senator Bill Stoltz, coming from Chugiak and joining us from the House side, welcome. Again, you've had a lot of experience in this area and the areas of finance, so we welcome your expertise. And Senator Bill Wilikowski, representing the part of the Anchorage area just north of me on in East Anchorage. This is not his first time on Senate Resources either. So again, we have a lot of experience here at the table. I'm Senator Kathy Geisel, the chair, representing a portion of East Anchorage and the Anchorage Hillside and Turnagain Arm. I want to introduce the Resource Committee staff, Ike Geolopsis. Ike, stand, take a wave there. I am really blessed to have Ike. He's got great expertise in this subject matter, and he's going to make sure that all of the committee members and their staff are up to date with information related to the committee. I also want to welcome and thank our very support staff, starting here with Ann Kreckelberg, who has been our recording secretary now for several years, 10, 15, okay, she doesn't count. The key here is that Anne keeps the minutes, and those minutes go online so that the public has access to what's happened here in committee. We also, speaking of public access, have Thatcher and Cody over here running the audio. They're a critical piece of the committee. They make sure that the public can hear us online and also hear us online and also here in the room. And we have Gavel to Gavel, who televises. So thank you, all of the support staff. You make us able to function more efficiently. So my goal for this committee is to craft policy and possibly remove some policy that will make Alaska an even more productive place to live for our citizens. We have very valuable assets in our water, rocks, forests, tundra, and mountains. And we want to make sure that we're using those responsibly. We had an expectation of access to and responsibility to develop these resources, which allowed Alaska to become a state. And we territorial kids like Senator Coghill and myself, who've been here our whole life, certainly remember that that's an important aspect. Our committee is charged with continuing that legacy. I can securely predict that we will have some vigorous discussions on this committee because they are such important issues. But I think it'll be great discussion, good input, wide variety of viewpoints. So I thank all the committee members for agreeing to join on this committee to serve here. I would remind the audience and the committee members to turn off your cell phones, please. And we'll go ahead and get started with today's meeting agenda. It's the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, AGDC, that will be presenting us to us today. So to start out, I'm going to welcome the AGDC president to the table, Mr. Dan Fauske. And I see joining you, Mr. Frank Richards, Vice President of Engineering and Program Management, as well as Joe Dubler, Vice President of Commercial Operations, so welcome. I know also David Haugen is here, Senior Project Manager with ASAP, and let's see, Miles Baker should be here as well. There's Miles, Vice President of External Affairs, Government Relations, and Fritz Krusen. Is Fritz here also?
He's online.
He's online. Wonderful. Mr. Fauske.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here, and Happy New Year to everyone, and happy session, and good luck with your session. I know you're just getting started.
You get me okay?
There we go.
All right. I'm just going to be brief. We've had a chance to talk, some of us. I want to go through just a few opening remarks, and I'd like the committee, if, with your permission, Madam Chair, to have an access to some of the technicians and the engineers and senior staff that have put a lot of this work together. Many of you know Joe Dubler and I worked for many years together as CFO of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and has been active in that with us, but also on the commercial side. And Joe's done an outstanding job, and of course Frank and Dave and Miles. But anyway, our agenda, we can flip through that. But the main objectives, develop natural gas. First, AGG is a public corporation in the state of Alaska with a legal existence separate and independent of the state, as was created in AS 3125010. We're to develop natural gas pipelines and Alaska LNG project and other natural gas transportation projects in state for the maximum benefit of Alaskans. Finance, construct, and potentially operate natural gas and other non-oil energy transportation systems. Provide economic benefits and revenue to the state. Assist DNR and DOR in maximizing the value of the state's royalty and tax gas. Hold the state's equity interest in liquefaction component of the Alaska LNG project, which is currently where we have most of our energy going on the AKLNG side. Advance an in-state pipeline capable of delivering North Slope natural gas to Fairbanks, South Central, and other communities within the state at the lowest possible cost. Our objectives are to commercialize Alaska's North Slope gas resource, secure a stable, affordable, long-term supply of energy supply for Alaskans, generate revenue, jobs, and economic growth, facilitate further oil and gas development, and maximize the overall benefit to Alaskans. And that is exactly what we're attempting to do. The news you're going to get today, I'm really pleased with on the class 3 estimates and the other work. Dave Haugen, who is the project manager on the ASAP side, has just done an outstanding. Dave and I were first together on this 4 or 5 years ago when this whole thing got started under, I think it was HB 369, and we were to deliver a report to the legislature, which we did. But the rest of us are ASAP, AKLNG. We go both sides on both projects. We recently had Frank, who was primarily doing the engineering oversight on the ASAP, is now on the AKLNG side. And so that was one of the goals we had in hiring people, was we knew there'd be crossover, and we weren't going to try and develop this huge bureaucracy. We were going to try and hire the people we needed to do both, because the idea is that, and I think I'm comfortable, there's not going to be two pipelines, I think. And so our job now is to utilize the information that we have and the work that we're doing to try and mold things and fold everything into one project without duplication, which is a promise we've made to the governor and legislator and others, that we would maximize the people's money to the best of our ability. So with that, I'd like to step back. I'm going to have Dave to come up, and we're going to start going through these slides. Thank you.
Sounds great. And for the record, if each speaker would identify themselves so that Ann can capture your name and the audience listening can know who you are.
Madam Chairman, for the record, my name is Frank Richards, Vice President for Engineering and Program Development for Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. What Dan just described to you is that we are essentially the state's gas pipeline corporation. And with that, as he suggested, we've developed and brought on board a team of world-class experts to advance these projects. So what I hope you'll be receiving from us today is really an overview of where we are in advancing both of the initiatives that the legislature gave to us, both the Alaska LNG project and as well as the ASAP project, and then identify what those teams have done and are doing to be able to work those projects to advance it for Alaskans. So this slide indicates, again, the two initiatives that were provided to us. Under ASAP, it was the authorities granted to us under House Bill 4 to advance in-state natural gas pipeline for energy relief for Alaskans. So that's one of the key distinctions between the two projects is ASAP is for, was designed for and is being ready to be built for energy for Alaskans, while the Alaska LNG project is really about the commercialization of the North Slope resources for world-class markets and to provide for energy relief for Alaskans. So the ability to tap into a line and provide that natural gas resources to address the high cost of energy for folks along the line. And then what AGDC also has is responsibility to look off the system too and how we can then help deliver some of that energy off to folks and communities off the road system, either by rail or by barge or however else we can get it to them. But in these two projects, the project sponsor for the ASAP project is essentially the state of Alaska. 100% of funding appropriated by the Alaska legislature, placed into the In-State Natural Gas Pipeline Fund, has been used to develop and advance the project to its current state, which is essentially completion of a Class 3 work estimate. While the AKLNG project is a combination with private sponsors, both the major producers with ExxonMobil, BP, Conoco, and TransCanada representing a portion of the project for the state, as well as ASAP or AGDC representing the 25% ownership in the LNG plant solely. So that's a key distinction. Now, in regards to the design objectives, the AKLNG is for an LNG export project. That means that the gas will be conditioned to a much lower level of CO2, to approximately 50 parts per million of CO2, while as the ASAP, we've designed it as a lean gas concept, which would allow for up to 3% CO2, which is essentially the NSTAR spec that many folks in South Central that utilize NSTAR for home heating and power generation live under. So that's where ASAP project is from the North Slope with a gas conditioning facility located in Prudhoe Bay down to South Central, tying into essentially the NSTAR system, the Beluga pipeline, and then it would flow out to homes and power generation facilities. While as the AKLNG project is, again, a gas conditioning facility on the slope with a pipeline leading to an LNG export facility at Nikiski. So those are two major distinctions. AKLNG is essentially three mega projects in one, with a major gas conditioning facility on the slope, a major pipeline, and then a major LNG export facility and marine terminals in Cook Inlet, whereas ASAP is a major gas conditioning facility and then a pipeline leading to existing infrastructure. So key distinctions between the two projects. AKLNG is a 42-inch diameter high-pressure pipeline, while ASAP is a 36-inch 1,480 PSI pipeline. Very small differences in diameter. The flow or the volumes through those, though, are considerably different. ASAP was designed in accordance with what was then the AGEA statutes and the AGEA license agreement with TransCanada to be capped at 500 million standard cubic feet a day. So that was the design flow that we were given and what we had designed to throughout the last 3 years up to this point of the Class 3 estimate. Now, we have just now completed this estimate in December of 2014, and our new estimate is approximately $10 billion for ASAP. That's compared to the $45 to $65 billion for AKLNG. So as you can see, there's a considerable difference in terms of the cost, but you have three mega projects as opposed to one mega project in ASAP. The workforce are fairly similar, and the time to construct are they're different because, again, you don't have that three-component aspect of AKLNG that you would have under ASAP. Now, with the work that we have done and with the schedule delay that we are now working towards, that means that ASAP will not be fully constructed until 2024. And the reason that we did that was because we saw that the work that we are doing under ASAP, we don't want to compete with AKLNG. AKLNG will provide the most benefit for Alaskans, and so we want to make sure that the work on ASAP will be beneficial to AKLNG, but not competitive.
So, Mr. Richards, just to clarify then, so are you saying then that you've kind of slowed down on the ASAP line, or you're kind of not progressing as quickly just so that you aren't in a competing situation?
Madam Chairman, we have some slides that we're going to address that. I would say that the ASAP work that we've done is essentially, you've heard the term FEED, front-end engineering and design. We have completed FEED for the ASAP project, and that's what is represented in the new Class 3 estimate. We're essentially at a 30%+ design of the project, so we are really ready to be able to take that out to the commercial market to see if there's interest. AKLNG, though, is in the pre-FEED stage, so they will be working on pre-FEED this year, hopefully making a determination to go into the FEED early next year, 1Q of 2016. So we'll have a side-by-side comparison of the schedule in later slides.
Okay. Let's pause for just 1 second. Any other questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think this part of the discussion is important, right? So AGEA is no longer in existence, and the reason for ASAP's progress is that so we understand all the options available to Alaskans, right?
Correct.
Just if you can please explain the expansion capacity of the 36-inch line. It really runs almost all the way up to the 42-inch capacity. So what is that expansion potential from the $500 million on up?
Correct. The ASAP project was designed with a single gas conditioning facility on the North Slope with the compressor station co-located within that facility. There were no intermediate compressor stations to flow the 500 million standard cubic feet. You can add compressor stations intermediately along the line, and you can ultimately, if we stayed within the same design concept with an ANSI 600 class appurtenances as well as the 1480 PSI pipe, you could flow up to 1.6 billion cubic feet a day.
Perfect.
Any other questions, committee members? Yes, Senator Sedman.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Just as a, you know, just as a suggestion, I assume there will be quite a few Alaskans that aren't as spun up on these subjects as hopefully we are here and used to working with it. And we are using a lot of acronyms and throwing in terms that on legislation that we've used and use a lot. But I would think there'd be a lot of people sitting home that are clueless even what we're talking about, to a great degree, because of the acronyms. And it'd be nice if we tried to avoid the acronyms so the people at home, who's the audience here, could follow along with this important subject matter, because it gets confusing fairly easy. And we shorten up the the verbiage and a lot of acronyms, but it'd also be nice to make sure all the staff members in the building, the new ones, can understand what we're talking about.
My apologies, Madam Chairman. I told myself not to use the acronyms, and I will try and identify what they represent in my discussions.
Very good. Further questions? Seeing none, before you proceed, I want to recognize that Representative Josephson has been joining us from the very beginning of the meeting. Welcome, Representative Josephson. All right, go ahead and proceed.
So, Madam Chairman, what we are trying to represent on these slides is essentially what the legislature gave to us was a mission to advance this project, the ASAP project. And with that, then, we have been accumulating state assets. And so what I mean by assets are essentially these are items that will benefit the state as an owner or a participant in a natural gas pipeline. So, for instance, right out of the chute with the passage of House Bill 369, the state was told to work with us and provide us a state right-of-way. So we have acquired 413 miles of state right-of-way granted to us unconditionally, and it's transferable. So that means that AGDC then has that right-of-way that is then can be transferred to the viable project that will proceed forward. So that's a major asset. We had completed in October of 2012 what was then the final environmental impact statement for the design concept at that time, and that was for a project that was a 24-inch, high pressure, 2,500 pounds per square inch, rich gas, meaning gas that contained natural gas liquids, that would have then been able to be used for export of those natural gas liquids, as well as providing gas for the home heating and power generation for Alaska. But at the end of that, what we saw was the mandate that the legislature gave us, which was easy access and low-cost access for Alaskans. So with that high-pressure-rich gas, it would have required what was known as straddle plants, plants that would have allowed the gas to come out of the natural of the pipeline and then remove the natural gas liquids and then a leaner gas to then flow into those communities for consumption in those communities, and then those natural gas liquids brought back into the line and then taken on down to the terminus. That was an extremely expensive plant. For Fairbanks, we were looking at almost $250 million for a straddle plant. So that's why we thought it would be better to change the gas composition to meet the intent of what the legislature gave us, which was easy access for Alaskans. So we did that in early 2016, and that meant that we had to then initiate a new National Environmental Protection Act action called the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement. That was initiated early this year. We have now created a new plan of development. Those are key documents that are required by the federal and state agencies as we move through this process. We have essentially written the environmental evaluation document that is then given to those federal agencies to be able to write the environmental impact statement. And we have gone through the first round of public scoping on this. So we hit 16 communities up and down the state. And we've, quite frankly, it was wonderful because folks were coming out and supporting the project. And so that was very, very good to see that there was, again, interest for us to be able to move this project forward. And then the additional environmental and engineering work that we've been doing over the last few years includes looking at all the river and stream crossings and then looking at the mechanisms to be able to advance the pipeline through those areas. We've done cultural resource surveys up and down the project. We've looked at the wetlands and made determinations on high, low, medium value wetlands and then gotten a jurisdictional determination from the Army Corps. So those are all major steps in any project that you would have to advance to be able to get to that point of a project sanction decision. We've done a tremendous amount of boreholes as well, where we had drilled in the we knew that the project from Prudhoe Bay to Cook Inlet was going to be paralleling the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and work that had been done and looked at by the producers and other iterations of large diameter natural gas pipelines. So we knew that there was a wealth of information that was available north of Livengood, because that was a common route from Prudhoe Bay south to Livengood and then either south to Valdez or east to Canada. And so we focused our efforts on the areas south of Livengood, across the Minto Flats, down through the Denali National and State Park areas, down to Cook Inlet. Those assets are, again, part of what AGDC holds now for the state. And it's with those assets then we've been able to then work in negotiation and essentially a trade with the AKLNG partners to be able to share information, ours from Livengood South and they from Prudhoe Bay to Livengood. And that has essentially saved the state tens of millions of dollars of costs for not having to duplicate that effort. We've also completed our air quality monitoring at the gas conditioning facility on the North Slope. That site is essentially, it is the same site that is will be used for both AKLNG and or ASAP. So that's where the projects are very common. And then what we've done in producing what is known as strain-based design pipe. This is pipe that must be able to withstand the rigors of discontinuous permafrost. Crossing discontinuous permafrost where you would have the potential for frost heave or thaw settlement, which would induce strain into the pipe, meaning the pipe would have to stretch to be able to handle the frost heave or the thaw settlement. So that means that it must have the metallurgy and the strengths to be able to handle those conditions. So that meant we had to design the metallurgy. We went out and essentially purchased pipe, 12 segments of pipe from three manufacturers around the world, from Germany, from Japan, and from India, because there weren't mills in the U.S. that could produce this high-strength pipe. So that we now have that pipe being tested. We're welding it together. We are pulling it apart to make sure that that pipe will meet the design standards that will be placed on us in these particular areas. We also have developed our line pipe specifications. That means that for those areas of discontinuous permafrost, we now have a pipe specification that will meet, again, the regulations that are placed on natural gas pipelines from the Pipeline Hazards Material and Safety Administrations. And we've been working on stipulations with that organization called PHMSA to be able to address their needs, because they have the responsibility, federal responsibility, to make sure that the pipelines are built and operated safely. And then most recently, we've completed what is known as a project execution plan. And that is a very detailed document that identifies not only how we are going to finish the design work, but also how we're going to construct it, and ultimately how we're going to operate it. So that's a very detailed document that essentially is the cookbook for how you're going to be able to advance a project. And that asset now is one of the key areas that we're also talking to our partners with AKLNG. Because of the work of Mr. Haugen and his previous expertise in building TAPS, he was able to bring a lot of that to this document, and it has become a valuable asset for the state. Now, that's just a smidgen of what we have. We have what you would expect for major design, with alignment sheets and march charts, which identify the progression. We have built a very robust graphical information system that defines and represents everything that we have put in place. And then, again, it's also we've completed this Class 3 estimate, which will clearly define what the level of cost will be for completing a project.
Great. Let's pause there for a second. Committee members, any questions? I wanted to ask, I thought I had heard that the Park Service actually was hoping you would build the pipeline through the park, because they want access to this gas too. Any truth to that?
Yes, Madam Chairman. Actually, Senator Murkowski had drafted a bill, and it was passed by the last Congress and signed into law by the President last year, which allows for a high-pressure natural gas pipeline to go through Denali National Park along the park's highway corridor. This was started prior to the inception of AGDC as an organization. It was by the original project developers, NSTAR, because they thought it would be, they needed that legislation to be able to have easy access, or to have access through the park. Because their concept was building a pipe as close to or within the DOT and railroad right-of-ways as possible. When we looked at that, the issue with being within the DOT right-of-ways is you need more steel, because you have to have the safety considerations of being next to a transportation corridor. So it's going to be more expensive. Within Denali National Park, though, if you build a project, you must comply with another federal law, and that's called ANILCA. And a provision under ANILCA is Title 11, which requires that all federal authorizations must be applied for simultaneously. So that is a problem, because normally in a sequence of a project you would be developing and applying for federal authorizations in a sequential time frame, and you'd be gathering information to meet those permit requirements as you are developing the project. If you want to bring them all back to a single simultaneous application, it delays the advancement of the project. Also within that, any federal agency has the authority to essentially veto the project, and then the only override of that is a presidential override of that veto. So that's why we've been very concerned about Title 11 and ANILCA, and we have kept our alignment off out and out of Denali National Park. ANILCA.
Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz.
Great. Well, thanks for answering that question. Further questions, committee members? Senator Stoltz.
We didn't get to the point, I wonder if one of the members could, Madam Chair, would give us a summarize or a characterization of the fish habitat issues and summary of the, and which of them are anadras, or salmon issues, and
yes,
through the geographical areas.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, we have had fisheries experts look at all of the 468 river and stream crossings that we have to do fisheries studies on those, specifically where we have anadromous fish streams, because we're going to have to look at the crossing mechanisms when we are building it, because the concern is going to be that we're not going to be impacting fish and spawning habitat. So that means that we will take into account those fishery recommendations, requirements coming in from permits that would be either by the state or the federal agencies, and bring that into how we would best construct it to not degradate the area. That means that wintertime versus summertime construction must be considered. So we have now built an inventory. Fish and Game has worked very cooperatively with us in building this inventory, and we have, I believe, we've met the intent of providing for the study what's called for essential fish habitat, and we've then fit that into the agencies as is a requirement of the NEPA process.
Further questions, Senator Schultz?
Just a semi-statement and hopefully a directive. The Mattsu Borough, Madam Chair, has been one of the certainly the leader within the state on habitat restoration, especially on culverts, and using the science of our Fish and Game Advisory Committee and of the Mattsu Borough. I think you'll find them a very useful source. I know our cabbage grower from Palmer there in the middle is very aware of that, and I think there's a real resource and maybe even some ability to leverage ability to their expertise and some of the projects they're already working on. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from committee members? Seeing none, go ahead and proceed.
Madam Chairman, the land ownership is, again, of keen interest. 55% essentially of the ownership is state land that has been granted to us through the right-of-way, and then almost 30% of it is federal. That will be the outcome of the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement, will be a record of decision, and with that granting will be the federal right-of-way across those federal lands. So that's a major asset that we are now working towards to complete this year, 2015. And then it's represented in terms of borough lands, some native allotments, and then a small percentage of private corporation lands.
Madam Chair, for the record, Joe Dubler, Vice President of Commercial Operations for AGDC. And I'd like to just go over the slide about Alaska LNG project participation. And I'm sure this committee's heard before, but for the sake, as Senator Sedman said, the public listening, the Alaska LNG project is made up of basically four resource owners, and those are the three main producers on the North Slope: British Petroleum, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil, and the state of Alaska as a resource owner in not only the royalty that the state owns, which is about 12.5%, about an eighth. On most of the fields, it's a little higher in some other fields, but it's about 12.5%. But also they're considering a tax as gas, where they would receive the production tax as a gas instead of in value. In other words, instead of the producers paying the state for the production tax, they would give them natural gas instead as a commodity that the state could then go and sell. So that's just one of the ways the state's getting equity in the project. And the reason the equity for the state is important is to assure alignment through the project. All of the resource owners have to be the same ownership percentage as the project interest, which is, you see up there on the slide. The state has approximately 25% interest at this point. We're still working out the numbers, but the proposal is about 25% of interest in the project. That it coincides with the percentage of gas that the state would own through the taxes gas and the royalty in kind. So the state's interest is currently represented by TransCanada in what they're calling the midstream. The midstream includes the gas treatment plant and the pipeline. As Frank said, those are both major projects. The gas treatment plant on the North Slope is a huge facility, and the pipeline is 800-mile, 42-inch steel pipe. The AGDC, which is the state's corporation, as Dan said earlier in the presentation, would own 25% of the LNG facility and marine terminal at Nikiski, which is the current site. That's how the state's involved in this project. It's got two owners, and the ownership that the state holds in the project is the same as the ownership of their gas. And that's important in an LNG project to keep that continuity throughout the project. So we'd like to talk a little bit about the coordination between Alaska LNG, Frank touched on earlier, and about the coordination between the large project and the ASAP line. And Frank, you want to start?
Yes, I mean, we've since the passage of HB4 and the granting to AGDC for confidentiality, we are now able to hold information confidential so that the exchange of information between the parties has been fostered in that regard. So in the spirit of cooperation, because, again, the intent that we got from both the legislature and the prior administration was not to spend the state's money twice. Mm-hmm. So if one or the other had assets that could be used, then we'd look to see how we can collaboratively work with that information. And so we have signed a cooperation agreement that was done in October of this year, and that resulted in then that first exchange of geotechnical data where the historic TAPS information, Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, borehole information, the work from the Alaska Pipeline Project as well as the Denali Pipeline Project were granted to AGDC, and AGDC was able to share the borehole information that we have of information from Live and Good South to the Alaska LNG Project. So that meant the intent of working collaboratively together and also to eliminate the duplication of work between the two projects. Because of the slow start in the joint venture agreement, then AKLNG hasn't had the folks brought on board as timely as they might have hoped, or the contractors brought on board. And AGDC has, in many instances, environmental consultants on board. We have geotechnical consultants on board. We have the authority granted by the legislature for expedited permit review by the agencies. That's one of the feathers in our cap, so that when we define what work we need to do, what we can do cooperatively together, we can get it done. And that's what we are doing starting this month. We are doing work for both the ASAP project and AKLNG under the auspices of AGDC. So that we felt was meeting the intent of the legislature, and that will ultimately save literally tens of millions of dollars in terms of project cost development. We have work proceeding forward where we have civil work, which is looking at the access roads and work pad design, the culvert building into those facilities, the hydrologic work, the fisheries work, the metallurgy work, the welding plans. All of that work is now looking to be shared between the two projects. So that coordination cooperation is a common theme that you're going to hear from us. Whereas AGDC is represented in the state in the LNG portion, but we're also working with the folks within TransCanada and the producers to be able to, and the pipeline and the gas treatment facility, to work collaboratively with them through that effort as well.
Madam Chair, the recent activity from the Alaska LNG project, for AGDC, our board approved the 2015 budget for the AKLNG project of $39.8 million. That's for calendar year 2015. That includes both the capital contributions we'll be making to the project in the form of cash calls from the project, and the staff time and consultants that the corporation is hiring to represent the corporation within the project team. We've held a joint workshop with AGDC, as Frank talked about, on sharing data and engineering. We've been working actively with that. We've already exchanged some historical data. We're working on future activities, coordinating the field season for next year, so that, like Frank said, we're not out there drilling boreholes next to each other in the same areas. The second bullet there we're particularly proud of. Alaskans comprise 79% of the 250-person workforce hired for the 2014 field season by the AKLNG project. This is something we've pushed very hard on from day one and our involvement on the project. We feel that, and not just because the state's involved in this project, but because the project is in the state of Alaska, that they should do everything that they can, or we should do everything we can, to ensure Alaskan content in the contractors and employees that are hired to build this pipeline. I think everybody that was up here during the original, during the TAPS, felt the frustration and probably remembers quite vividly the frustration they had in the 70s with the people brought in from the lower 48 to accomplish that project, and we're trying to avoid that, you know, with this project. So we've been pushing very hard, and actually we've gotten the producers themselves are now bringing this up and saying, well, what's the Alaskan content on this group, or what's the Alaskan content on that? It's very important to everybody involved in the project. The project is also actively soliciting additional Alaskan content through its website. It's got on their website, there's a thing where contractors can go on and put their name out there to get on a list for future bidding. So that's something that they've done. Engineering contracts that have been awarded and design work is underway for a gas treatment plant. They awarded to URS, is a firm, and I actually looked the the acronym's up, Mr. URS is United Research Services. They're based out of San Francisco. They're a very large company. They'll be designing the gas treatment plant on the North Slope. They're also getting help from CBI, which is Chicago Bridge and Iron. They're headquartered in Houston, and AES, which has which is Arctic Slope Regional Corp Energy Services. They're based up in Alaska, so there's some Alaska there. That work's being done in Denver. The pipeline's being designed by Worley Parsons, and it's actually being done in Calgary, Canada. So, but they're the LNG plant is done by, again, CBI, Chicago Bridge and Iron, with Kyota and AES, Arctic Slope Energy Solutions. Kyota is a Japanese firm based out of Yokohama, Japan. But that work's being done in Houston as well. And what that means for us, we've got our project manager, Fritz Krusen, is on board. We got him on board a few months ago. He ends up traveling quite a bit. He'll be, I think he's in Houston this week, as a matter of fact, at a meeting. So that's not ideal, but that's where the people that do this these types of engineering projects are. The marine facilities are being done by CH2M Hill in Houston, and with some content from Anchorage as well. They're working on both the jetties and the docks and everything that are planned for Nikiski. So we're actually pretty happy with the content so far in Alaska. AES has had quite a bit of work, as has CH2M Hill. So we're pretty happy. And subs that these groups hire too, they're looking for Alaskan content as well. Under regulatory, the Department of Energy authorized LNG exports to free trade countries. That was several months ago. They got that authorization. And FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, approved a pre-filing request on September 8th. And what that does is that allows the FERC employees to start working with the project for a filing at some later date. The project has already filed resource reports 1 and 10 for the environmental impact statement, and they're working on the other reports. I believe there's 12 total.
12.
I believe there's 11. 11 total. And I know they're going through final reviews on several of them right now. We've been getting them. They've conducted over 60 public meetings up and down the alignment from the Nikiski all the way to the North Slope, and they did a media tour through the site in Nikiski on October 9th. And I'm sure I saw it on the news, and I don't watch that much news, so I'm sure a lot of people saw it as well.
So if you would pause here for a moment, Mr. Dubler. So on these resource reports, those are available to the public now on a website, I think. True?
Madam Chair, 1 and 10 are, because they've been completed. They're, right. And we can get you that information. So I don't have it off the top of my head, but I know it's on FERC's website. There's a and we'll get you that off it. Yeah, we'll
okay.
Get you that.
That'd be great, because it is important that Alaskans engage in this now.
Yes.
And take a look at these reports. My understanding is that report number 5 will be the socioeconomic impact, and that's us, right? How it's going to impact us. Is that right?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. So when do you anticipate the rest of the reports being out? Any time frame or hard to say?
I know 5 is one that's going through final review right now, because my staff were just looking at it, the people that have got a lot of experience in that area. And so that should be out soon. And that is a very, very informative report. All of these are very detailed reports. I was amazed when I started looking through the kind of detail that they put in these reports. It's very impressive.
Great. So that's something that we, as representatives of the public, need to push out to our constituents to make sure they know they're there and have the opportunity to read them.
Yes, Madam Chairman, we'll make sure that you get what's known as the pre-filed docket, and that's where those reports will be found. And I believe that the schedule is that they hope to get the initial drafts out in February to FERC, which would then go out to the public, and then through a public process, and then they would do another set of drafts later in 2015. So there'll be multiple opportunities to comment on these.
Great. I think my staff was just writing that down, and we'll make sure that all of the Senate gets that information, and we'll pass it on to the House as well. Committee members, any questions at this point? Great. All right, I'll let you go ahead and proceed.
Madam Chairman, we're going to switch back to the ASAP project and allow Mr. Haugen to talk about the outcomes of what's known as the Class 3 estimate.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Dave Haugen. I'm the Senior Project Manager for the ASAP project. And as Frank has mentioned, as well as Dan, the Class 3 estimate was prepared and delivered to our board just prior to the end of the year. And let me just step back a little bit to explain the significance of that. Earlier estimates were a combination of Class 4 numbers, and these are accuracy terms that deal with just how rigorous the estimating work is done. So in a prior estimate in 2012, we had progressed the work further with the pipeline portion of it than we had with the gas conditioning facility at Prudhoe Bay. We've caught up now so that the current estimate reflects a full Class 3 estimate for both the gas conditioning facility as well as the pipeline. So if you look at the slide and the numbers shown there, you can see that, again, as was mentioned before, with the contingency number of $861 million in our estimate, our Class 3 total is just under $10 billion. And that represents $1.8 billion or so variance from the Class 3 estimate done in 2012, or Class 4 estimate done in 2012, excuse me for that. And let me explain some of the reasons why that occurred. In some of the 2012 estimating work, some numbers were because of the type of work being done. There were factored estimates, which is means the best available knowledge was put in place, but it was not done on a grassroots on-up basis. In this particular estimate we've just delivered on, we've gone back and actually re-estimated the entire project, and we've used real-world contractors as part of that process. So, for instance, on the pipeline part of the project, we've employed, on the civil side, we've incorporated estimates that have been done by folks that most people recognize, Peter Kiewit, as a big civil construction organization, the Bryce Companies out of Fairbanks, Alaska Frontier Constructors. These are the kind of folks that we brought in and had them prepare an estimate as if they were actually bidding the work. And similarly so on the pipeline portion of it. So we brought in people like Associated, Doyon Associated, that's a pipeline organization with years of experience in Alaska, as well as Price Gregory, that's been around for quite some time, the Michaels Corporation and Rockford Corporation. These are folks that are in the business, and they were given all the plans and specifications, and it was given to them and said that what we wanted to see from them was a full-blown estimate as if they were going to be actually performing the work. So because of that, the accuracy now for the Class 3 is much better than it was for the Class 4. And that's not the end of the story. We'll be progressing this estimate in the future as well, and eventually before the sanctioning of the project occurs, it'll actually get to a Class 2 estimate, so that when you get to the sanctioning time on a project this size, or if it were the AKLNG project, the same way, that you've got a reasonable degree of certainty that the project will actually come in on budget. And that's the progression through a stage gate approach that both projects are part of and contributing to. As Frank mentioned, we are sharing a lot of the data that we've accumulated now with this cost re-estimate. And we've just had workshops, as a matter of fact, just in the last couple of days with Alaskan LNG personnel. And they've been very keen on getting access to this kind of data, because obviously this will help them expedite their project. It avoids them having to go through the same iteration of, if they would choose to do so, to go out and get the same kind of folks assembled as contractors and go through the same analysis. And because of that, we think we can expedite both projects in moving them forward. So in addition to the what's called a total installed cost number that's just under the $10 billion, we also did further work on calculating of real operations. The O&M stands for operations and maintenance, and this is an average annual cost. That was built up, again, with real-world expertise. We brought in people from Alyeska Pipeline that have had many years of experience with the operations and maintenance of Alyeska, and incorporated their thoughts as to what would be required. It's interesting, the 2012 estimate was a factored estimate, and you can see it actually was not that far off the mark when we went back and did it on a more rigorous fashion. So that's sometimes shows you that factoring can be a good number, but it needs to be verifiable. And this time around, the numbers that you're seeing are all verifiable. The thing that was not estimated in prior times is DR&R, which is dismantlement, restoration, and
recovery.
I can never remember all three of them. But that's end-of-life costs that are part of the project. In other words, when the project is finally over and done with, you've ceased operations, then what's the cost of putting it to bed? And in the case of a gas pipeline project like this, that'll require the removal of all the facilities like the gas conditioning facility, and if there are intermediate compressor stations, things like that, the above ground part of the project will have to be taken away, the site's restored, and they'll probably allow the pipe itself to be capped, to be purged and capped and left in place. Mm-hmm. So those costs are shown, but they're way at the very final end of the project, and when you put that back into today's dollars with the cost of money and all that, it's not really a significant dollar amount, but it does get incorporated into the tariff rates. So that's why we had to do the estimate. And then finally, the state of Alaska's money is in the estimate. That $353 million is the cost that the state's upfronting for our project, and that's incorporated in part of the capital cost that's in our project, just to make sure that it isn't kept off to the side. That's all part of where we're at. So again, just on the bottom of the page, you can see the breakout between the gas plant at the North Slope. It's a significant number. Almost one-third of the cost of the project is up on the North Slope, which is just the penalty you pay because the gas up there has to have lots of conditioning to make it usable, and then the pipeline and others. Others in this case means a lot of the owner costs, cost of interest during construction, supervisory, costs for the owner, whoever that might be, if it's the state of Alaska or other venture partners that are part of it. All those costs are in that one line item as well. So that got us to the final numbers that you see at the bottom of the page, and that's what's now our standalone Class 3 estimate for the ASAP project. So I'll just pause there because the next page gets into what does that mean for tariffs, and so if anyone wants questions.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, for those listening in or online, these numbers that are represented here are thousands of millions, and so that means it represents billions. So the 9,968 is millions, is $9.968 billion.
Very good. Thank you for clarifying that. Senator Stedman had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Several years ago, some of us attended a mega project seminar. In fact, a couple of us went through twice. Maybe we needed a little extra help. But over the years, it's been available at least twice. And it's one of the factors I remember coming out of that is it's you classify a mega project, basically over a billion some odd bucks, and this is clearly $10 billion plus, as a mega project, most of them go over budget, the vast majority, very few under. And if you're only over, if you only miss the budget and you go over by 20%, that's a success. If you, in this case, you know, if you think it's going to cost you $10 billion and it costs you $12 billion, that's a success. If it costs you $20 billion, well, maybe that's not so successful. So how do we as policymakers factor in the large discrepancy between the expectation on mega projects and then the reality of high probability that it's going to be over budget, and most of them hit somewhere around 20 to be even successful or less?
Well, Senator, through the chair, we are very cognizant of that particular effort. In fact, the people you're talking about, the Independent Project Analysis (IPA), is our Bible. We set in motion when we started the project that we would follow that methodology, and that is as he mentions in the book. Ed Murrow in his book talks specifically about the importance of stage gate approach to a project. So a while back we went through the FEL1 phase, which was the bracketing part. We're still in what's called front FEL2, front end engineering, in phase two, and we're not completed with that yet. And the whole idea is that every time you do another estimate, you try to hone up and get the numbers even tighter. And in this case, again, in addition to these contractors providing their real-world expertise on as if they were bidding the project, in the case of the gas conditioning facility, our contractor that we had on this went out and actually got real quotes from the actual manufacturers of the equipment that's installed in the gas conditioning facility. So we are trying as best we can to try to keep down the level of swing that can be in there from what we are now publishing as an estimate as opposed to what really will happen. Now, having said that, there are still elements that are still things that we can't control, such as the future rates of inflation, the future costs of some of the major components, the pipeline, steel itself, the major equipment, the long lead items for the gas conditioning facility. Those are world market type activities, and when and if this project does get built, either one of them, you know, at that point in time, when you pull the trigger on project sanction, we're going to be up against other market conditions. So they can easily sway this from being a project that comes within budget to something that doesn't. The other element, which I would be negligent if I didn't add to this, is the regulatory environment that you're party to. And in some cases, in this project in particular, we are still dependent upon a reasonable amount of regulatory oversight, but we can't control that. And we have a new entrant here on pipeline construction called PHMSA, Pipeline Hazardous Materials and Safety Organization. And they are very keen on and have a new mandate from Congress to be very specific about their regulations on the pipeline itself. And we don't have a good feel for what that oversight will end up costing the project. We have made assumptions on what it will be, but again, we don't know that for certain. And that just highlights, I'm not trying to make excuses. What I am trying to point out is some of these things we can do the best we can and try to make sure that the costs are accurate to the best available knowledge that we have at the time. But in some cases, we still don't have control over other factors that can make our estimate have some variability to it. And Frank, you...
No, I think it's really about setting in, as Dave said, putting in place controls so that where you have that availability or the ability to control it, you do that to the best of your knowledge. But market forces are going to be what market forces, and we're not going to be able to control that.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman? All right. Senator Machicki, you had a question?
I did. Mr. Hagan, just if you can explain the spectrum. There's some conservatism in the estimates by your P75 risk-based analysis. Can you kind of explain that to folks so that they know you already have a spectrum of consideration in your cost analysis?
Okay. What's represented, again, in the contingency, the footnote at the bottom is that we were identified that we're using a P75 risk-based Monte Carlo analysis. That means that of the nearly 8,000 lines of the estimate, 8,000 individual items were rolled up into this estimate, we did a Monte Carlo analysis, which is essentially a black box analysis, looking at the determination, the probabilistic determination of that cost being reasonable, or is there a 50% probability that the cost would be higher or lower, or 75% that it would be lower, or 100%. So we had to make a determination then on what probability we wanted to include in this. We could have gone with a P85, which would have been a higher contingency level. We could have gone with a P50, which was a lower contingency level, but we landed on P75 for this phase of the project. Again, we're in, as Dave said, the front-end FEL2, front-end loaded phase 2, and we felt that P75 was contingent on with that level of estimate.
Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Machicki?
No, thanks.
No. Further questions? Senator Welikowski.
Thank you. I share Senator Stedman's concern. The costs have gone from $7.7 billion to $9.9 billion in the course of a year or so. And we all know that with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the costs originally were projected to be around $900 million, and then ultimately TAP's costs about $9 billion, so they were off by a huge factor. I guess my question is, What's the plan? Do you go out and secure contracts from NSTAR, from MLNP, from other corporation, other gas providers? And then if you're off, let's say you're off by another 20-30%, is that just added onto the tariff so the consumers pay for it? Or who's ultimately going to pay if the costs are off?
That's a commercial.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, there's a number of different ways you can structure a tariff. Typically, the shipper, in this case, would be an NSTAR that's shipping the gas or purchasing the gas on the other end, would take some of the risk, and the pipeline company would take some of the risk. But it depends on the negotiation and how that goes and how much. And again, what they will look at is they will look at your estimate, and they'll say if we've got a P75, we've got a P90, they might have more comfort because the number's a little harder than a P75 would be. So it depends on the quality of the estimate and the quality of the work that we've put into it would determine what level of risk they'd be willing to take.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski? All right. A couple things. First of all, we were joined for a while there by Representative Chenault. He did step out again, but he was here for a while, and Senator Huggins is here in the room, so welcome, Senator Huggins. Also, gentlemen, as you answer questions, if you would identify yourself, again, for Ann's benefit as well as folks listening online, you know, the TV, you'll be the TV stars, so we got to know who you are, right? All right. Further questions? Oh, pardon me, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The panel on the issue of the cost of wetland permits, the mitigation, and the cost of permitting, as we're addressing some of these budget cut issues, it might be helpful if you can help us with what the cost of that would be, and if the issue of whether the state had primacy or not, would that be a worthwhile investment? I'm not trying to polish the chairwoman's apple here, but I know that's one of your issues as well, that it might help us make one of those smarter budget decisions if this thing happens to go forward.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, in regards to wetlands mitigation, essentially what this means is that the federal government has identified that wetlands have a national interest, and therefore that there should be mitigative measures that when you impact wetlands, depending on high, medium, or low value wetlands, that there should be a monetary mitigation paid by the project sponsors. In this case, in Alaska, what we're seeing is wetlands mitigation numbers are going up, and going up quite high. So what we had originally envisioned maybe back in 2012 as maybe $2,000 per acre of wetlands, in some projects now around the state, we're seeing values in excess of $20,000. In some areas of the state, we're seeing wetlands mitigation values in excess of $40,000 per acre. So for our project and I believe the numbers are now below 10,000 acres of wetlands mitigation, of wetlands impacts, that we're looking at a fairly substantial amount. And I believe that we included approximately $200 million for wetlands mitigation for the impacts of this project. Mm-hmm. Now, we've been talking to the agencies, the state agencies, specifically the large program office within DNR, who has the responsibility for help shepherding large projects, about the issue of wetlands mitigation. And they feel that there may be mechanisms that the state could assume, not the primacy, but assume and put in place land banks that would allow us to not have to then pay the state for a state impacted project and save literally hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm. I hope that we'll be able to have those discussions this year in the legislative process, because again, for any large project, whether it be a transportation project, a utility project, a gas pipeline project, the cost of mitigation is becoming a major factor. And I believe as a state with the ownership of literally millions of acres of wetlands, there are alternatives that we can put in place.
Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Stoltz?
Just to follow up the issue of primacy, does that affect this at all?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I'm not an expert on primacy. I believe that there, Mr. Roro from Senator Stedman's office has been working that issue, and I'm not at liberty, I don't have the knowledge to be able to answer the question.
Madam Chair, if that would be helpful as we're dealing with these budget issues, and is it a pound, pennywise, pound foolish type thing? And that's this one project alone, if it's relevant, could more than compensate for that. But I don't know, and I'm just going on speculating. I'm just fishing right now. And it's one of the... I'm using a rod and reel. Precision.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing it up, Senator Stedman, or excuse me, Senator Stoltz. Further questions?
I have one, Madam.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
It's kind of important, and this is the Senator from Anchorage brought up a 1,000% premium on the TAPS line, and I think it's just kind of important. We're at a P75 right now. Just a question for Mr. Hagan. Where are we generally at an FID, or final investment decision, for a level of confidence?
Well,
generally.
Senator Machicki, Mr. Chair, as I talked to the Class 3 that we're currently at, by the time you get to an FID, the final investment decision, it'll require, in most cases, the Class 2, and that would be within a range of plus or minus 10%. That would be what most investors would look to at that point in time, and shippers, as being a reasonable amount of variation that they'd feel comfortable enough at that point in time to go ahead and tender their gas, subject to the negotiations that Mr. Duber talked about on the risk-sharing element, because that still will be part of the tariff negotiations. And we'll get into that in a little bit in the next slide or so on how that will work. But that's the objective, would be to advance from where we're currently at on our project to a Class 2 when the time comes for project sanction.
Follow-up.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Machicki.
So the question I'm leading toward, you had a little bit of involvement in the TAPS construction, I understand. would you say that a P90 of building a Trans-Alaska pipeline in 2019 will be more accurate than a P90 in the late 70s?
Senator Machicki, through the chair. First of all, I was on the Alaska project almost from its inception. And if you recall, I understand now in today's world, not many of us old-timers left that can recollect that far back, but the original concept for Alyeska was a buried pipeline its entire distance in the 1968 time frame at the Discovery Well point in time. So the original estimate of $800 million at that point in time was based around a conventionally buried oil pipeline. Well, as we all know that have been around this for some time, nothing was known about really at that point in time when it was at the inception about the technology required to actually be able to get a hot oil pipeline across permafrost areas. So that between the time frame of 1968 and 9, after the Discovery Well, till construction actually began, it called for a completely new design, and ended up that over half of the project had to be an elevated pipeline. And along with that was the fact that it was the first major project built after the NEPA law was passed, the National Environmental Protection Agency. And no one at that time knew of the implications that would call into play. So, yes, it's true. It went from original $800 million estimate to $8 billion. But there are a lot of factors that made that project, when it was finally actually under construction and then completed, a totally different project than when it was originally contemplated. Now, hopefully, on our project, we've been more consistent on our design. But even so, it could still change designs. And anytime designs change, design premises change, and other change conditions occur, it needs to be a re-estimate. And those need to be carefully tracked, because the history on major projects, as Senator Stedman has said, is not a good record. But a lot of times, it's due to scope changes as much as anything else. So I think everyone needs to be alert for anyone that comes along to try to change the scope of the project, and then make sure that if it does change, the cost elements are taken into account when those are asked for or directed to be done so by whoever that might be, whether that comes from the regulatory side or just market conditions or whatever, because that can explain an awful lot of what happens to mega projects on why there's a consistent pattern of cost overruns. And I'm not trying to make apologies for the project. I'm just trying to state it as my experience was on the project.
Follow-up, Senator Matucci?
No.
No. Senator Stoltz, did you have a question?
No. I was just wondering, was there a PLA on that project?
I'm just kidding.
You know, speaking of projects being overcost, you know, we hear about Australia, of course. But I am aware that the lead folks on the AKLNG project actually brought a project online on budget and on time. And so that's an encouragement. We're working with a team on by the big producers that have actually done this before and done it successfully. So that kind of helps somewhat the comfort level, though there's so much unknown. Thank you, and go ahead and proceed. And I do want to remind you again, as you're answering a question, if you could just identify yourself again. I know it seems redundant, but it's protocol. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Joe Dubler. I'm going to go real quickly through the estimated tariffs based on the cost numbers that Frank and Dave just showed you. And just I'll start off with just quick definitions. MMBTU stands for thousands of British thermal units. That's a BTU. That's a measure of heat, and it's basically the amount of heat or the amount of energy it takes to raise the temperature of 1 pound of water 1 degree. Which 1 pound of water is about a pint. So to raise it 1 degree is about, and it's about the equivalent of a kitchen match, a wooden kitchen match. That's a BTU. So and the MMSCFD at the bottom of that box is 1,000 standard cubic feet per day.
Million
standard cubic feet per day, sorry. So if we look at the tariff rates in 2014, we're looking in Fairbanks, the tariff rate of $5.50 to $6.75, and the range is based on if you look down at the bottom, the cost of gas is really unknown until we hold an open season, find out what people are willing to sell gas to us for, and it's just a pass-through to the project, so it doesn't matter to AGDC. The end user is the one who pays that. We're just doing the tariff. Mm-hmm. That'll come in burn tip cost. Apologies. The local distribution cost down below also, in Anchorage, it's about $1.50 for NSTAR. The IGU is estimated approximately $4 in Fairbanks because they have to build out that whole system. So we've used those for Fairbanks, and that's why the burner tip cost, which the burner tip is the cost of the gas that, you know, your Aunt Hazel uses to make the lime jello pudding that everybody loves. That's what it costs her to do that. And that would be about $11.50 to $14, where currently they're paying, I think the information we've got is around $21. So this is
a substantial reduction.
Yeah, substantial reduction from what they're currently paying. In Anchorage, the tariff rate to Anchorage, because of the longer distance, would be between $8 and $9.75, which would give you a burner tip cost of $11.50 to $14.50. And that's a little bit more than we're paying now. And I think the issue there is certainty of supply, and the North Slope certainly has that, and Cook Inlet, depends on who you believe, does or does not. So,
one thing I would add, Madam Chairman,
yes,
is that these numbers, the 2014 numbers, include the operations and maintenance costs that we talked about up front, and the dismantle, removal and recovery, as well as the 20-year life depreciation and the cost of capital. That was slightly, we were more aggressive in 2012. We had to think 30-year depreciation life. Now we're at 20, and then the cost of capital we're showing at a higher cost as well. So we feel these are conservative numbers.
Very good. Senator Wilikowski had a question.
Thank you. So can you explain the range in the burner tip cost, why you have that range there? Is that assuming that the cost of the project could flex, or why do you have that range?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, for the record, Joe Dubler. The range from $11.50 to $14, if you see the $5.50 is the tariff, and that's what we'd be charging, the $6 difference between those is the Fairbanks, the $4 and the $2 cost of gas, the $4 local distribution and the $2 cost of gas, and the range on the cost of gas is $2 to $3.30. So the range on the upper side is $7.30, which is $3.30 and the $4. And we quote a range that just to make, because you know, the minute we say it's going to cost $11.23 or $11.73, that implies a level of accuracy that quite frankly doesn't exist. I mean, at the level we're at now with the P75, there's that degree of accuracy is not possible.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
Still not clear on... So part of it's the cost of gas, which is a $1.30 difference, right?
Yes.
Then there's still another $2.70, roughly. No. $1.70.
Through the
I'm
chair.
I'm curious where that's from. Where that is that you expect the cost? Are you assuming that the cost could be off by 20 a certain percentage? Is that where it comes from?
Part of it is the actual construction cost, where we didn't say it's exactly $10 billion. So there's a cost factor built in and the gas.
Okay. All right, thank you.
And the range just helps to give people an idea instead of, again, pinpointing a number.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Could you remind us what capital structure you guys are looking at and the ranges that seem to be reasonable?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, for the record, Joe Dubler. The capital structure we're looking at, are you talking about depreciation years or
cost of capital construction?
Oh, right. The debt to equity is a 70-30, and we're assuming, I believe these runs were 25-year depreciation life?
20.
Okay. We did many iterations.
If I could follow up, Senator Stedman.
Could you give us a feel for if you change that, to some other number, if the state decides to put in more equity to drive the ownership cost down, how sensitive these numbers are to changing that structure?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, if the equity is the higher cost of the two different cost of funds, your equity we're assuming a 12% cost of equity, where the debt we're assuming a 5.7, and that's equity investors typically require a higher return than a bondholder. If the state were to just contribute money, for instance, like the $400 million that they put in up front, I believe the number was for every $1 billion, it reduced the tariff about 50 cents.
Yes,
this is a follow-up, and it's not really the subject of this presentation, but that's one way that the state has the ability to move down that tariff and deliver that gas to the citizens cheaper is by just equity infusion straight into it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. So if the debt-to-equity split is 70-30, is the assumption that the state will contribute 30% in general fund, and then you'll go out and bond the other 70%? I mean, is that the general structure you're looking at?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, for the record, Joe Dubler. If you go back to the prior screen, The only state contribution is the $353 million shown there. The 30% equity is assumed to be contributed by what we call an owner-builder-operator, and the owner-builder-operator would contribute equity to the project and in return get the 12% return that I talked about earlier. So it's a full – we would bring in a pipeline company to basically build this thing, because the state obviously – doesn't build pipelines. You'd bring in a professional pipeline company to build it. They would bring their 30% equity, and for that they would get a 30% return, or 12% return, sorry.
Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Panel, on your tariff projections and estimations, are you factoring in potential conversions of the military installation closest Wainwright and possible reopening of Flint Hills or the big one, Golden Valley Electric.
For the record, Joe Dubler, through the chair, Senator Stoltz, no, we are not. The tariffs, as we say at the bottom, burner tip excludes any conversion costs at customer's end. We're calculating these tariffs as if we were a pipeline company that is going out and building it. And if, you know, and when NSTAR, when you hook up to the NSTAR, if they come in and bring gas to your subdivision, they don't pay to convert your gas or your oil-fired stove to a gas stove. I mean, they bring the gas to your thing and you pay them for the gas, and that's how it works, and we're assuming the same thing here.
Follow-up,
yeah, I was actually, you know, thinking of the demand and how it sounds like you're using the most cautious scenarios, but those are three pretty big anchor users potentially?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, we are currently looking at business development and looking at what entities and communities up and down the line would make sense to hook up to this project, and that would include in Fairbanks. We'd be looking at the university. I know they're building a coal-fired generator. I think they got an appropriation last couple of years, so they probably would not be included. The bases, we've been talking to them early on. We talked to them, and they were non-committal at this point, but we are talking to all the potential customers along the route.
I imagine people are non-committal, Madam Chair, when they don't see a gas line.
That has been an issue. I mean, this isn't the first time a gas line has been proposed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Stedman.
We've gone over some of the stuff previously, but we'll go over some of it again, I guess, because it's kind of a new session started up and so on and so forth. But you have your debt to equity, and you've got your 12% return on equity, which seems to be attractive and seems to be a fairly common number from my understanding within the gas line business. Why isn't there a gas line company pounding the table to build this project if it's so potentially, I guess, marketable? Well, let me add that without a substantial state equity infusion, because we can make virtually any of these projects economic with a little bit of equity or a big chunk of equity.
Madam Chair, for the record, Joe Dubler, Senator Stedman, we have begun working with or at least attempting to get a contract in place with a what we call an owner builder operator, a pipeline company, and they are very interested in working on this project. The reason that we had difficulty getting someone at the very beginning of this project was it was at a feasibility stage and we talked to them 3 years ago, 4 years ago. We flew down, talked to 11 different companies, and they all said, look, with the history of gas pipelines in Alaska and the failures of gas pipelines in Alaska, you've got $300 or $400 million to put into this before we can determine if this is really going to work. And before we commit our capital, we want to make sure it's going to work, because I mean they're gamblers, but they got to have a pretty good idea that there's going to be a payoff at the end. So nobody was willing to put that money up front. That's why the state put the $400 million up, and that was what we testified to 3 or 4 years ago. And we got the appropriation. We've been working on it. We believe that a pipeline company will come in and put their capital up with the numbers that we're seeing, and we think that we can do that.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
The reason I brought that up, it's one of the, I guess, the backstop arguments of the original bill that we passed a couple of years ago, got this ball rolling, why we're here today, why there's not an Enbridge or a TransCanada or somebody else sitting there saying, just, you know, help us build this particular project, get out of the way. We're trying to, I guess, stimulate it because we couldn't get a gas line company to come in and put down $200 to $300 or $400 million to find out if it's a feasible project for them, as I recall, anyway, the process.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, I'll let you proceed.
Madam Chairman, very quickly, again, this slide, number 14, really just gives a history of why we, for the ASAP project, designed to a 500 million standard cubic foot a day throughput. And that was really due to what was known as the AGIA license, the Alaska Gasoline Inducement Act, the TransCanada, as well as the AGIA statutes that limit any in-state natural gas pipeline competing to less than 500 million. So that was put in place back in 2008, and then with the termination of the AGIA license in June of 2014, that cap or that ceiling went away. Now, the work that we had underway was far enough along that we weren't going to change design parameters. At that point, we were going to complete the work, and that's what we did in December of this year. But I just wanted to point out we're no longer statutory constrained to 500 million, and with changes in compression and pipe strength, treatment capacity, we can change the premise to have a different size project.
Good. Question by Senator Walikowski.
Thank you. What sort of interest are you getting in terms of MMBTUs? Because it seems 500 has always been low. It makes the tariff extremely high. I mean, are you seeing interest for 1 BCF or 1.5 BCF?
Madam Chair, for the record, Joe Dubler, Senator Walikowski, we The only really expression or solicitation we've done for interest was a non-binding expression of interest we did in 2011 that we got about 500 million cubic feet, which happened to coincide with our 500 million cubic foot line, and that gave us at least confidence to continue forward with 500, because it said, okay, there's at least 500 in interest. We have not gone out again with tariff numbers or tried to project tariffs at higher volumes and see what we could get, because we haven't had the engineering to back anything like that up yet. But that would be our intent when we go out for an open season, to the extent we do another open season or we do an open season in the future, we would have indicative tariffs at the higher volumes to see if it brought in additional interest.
Good. All right, let you continue.
Madam Chairman, this slide represents, again, for the record, Frank Richards. This slide, number 15, represents the spend plan. The top line is what we had originally provided to the legislature, that what it would take for us to develop a project through the project sanction was approximately the $353 million. And that red line represents what we have in remainder, $149 million. Now, with the passage of Senate Bill 138 and the signing of the joint venture agreement, we saw within AGDC that the AKLNG project was going to be the state's priority, and that any work being done for the ASAP project really should be done to keep the project a viable project, do work that was going to be durable and provide assets to the state of Alaska and potentially transferable to the AKLNG project, so the synergies that would be there for both projects. So we saw that we weren't going to be going to an open season in the near term, really until the AKA Alaska LNG project makes their decision on whether or not to proceed into front-end engineering and design. That's slated to be in the first quarter of 2016. So we've revised our spend plans down to that green line, that lower line, which represents the work activities that we'll be doing over the next 15 months. Again, meeting those parameters of durability, transferability, and benefit as an asset to the state of Alaska. At that point, when a decision is made to proceed or not within Alaska LNG, would really be a watershed moment for the ASAP project. Should AKLNG proceed into FEED, then the Alaska Standalone Pipeline project would fall back, because then all the horses would be fully pulling towards advancing the sole project, the Alaska LNG project. Now, if the decision is to not proceed into FEED by AKLNG, then the state of Alaska would still have the asset of the Alaska Standalone Pipeline project to advance and to meet the needs that the legislature has given to us. So that's really why that first quarter 2016 is a watershed moment for the Alaska Standalone Pipeline project.
Very good. Questions? Seeing none. Yes, Senator Coghill.
Just to fill that for those of who are listening, between 2015 and 2016, you have a slow spend down plan. What are some of the project issues that you will be dealing with in that particular time frame?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, as I identified earlier, we have the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement that is in the works and process now with the Army Corps of Engineers. We would complete that process. And again, that would result in a record of decision and a federal right-of-way grant to AGDC. We'll continue our metallurgy work that we're doing right now for the 36-inch 1480 PSI pipeline to be able to make sure that we have a pipe that will be able to withstand the rigors. We'll continue our work efforts with PHMSA, the Pipeline Hazardous Material and Safety Administration, to better understand their requirements for the execution of the project as well as the operations of the project proceeding forward. And then we would look within the gas conditioning in terms of optimization of how we have designed that plant and how we would construct that plant to maybe look at reducing the costs. So those are the three main areas of environmental, pipeline engineering, some facilities engineering, and then also I left out our construction maintenance and inspection programs that we would then look at what are the long-term lead items and how we can best position our project to be able to shave off what would be months, if not years, of pre-development work to be able to advance the project.
I just wanted to hear it out loud again, because the $60 million gets you there, but the $149 million would have got you to an open season.
through the chair, Senator Coghill, we would have gone to an open season and then made modifications based on what the shipper requirements were, and then get into a final investment decision.
I just wanted to be able to wrap that up with that kind of clear parameter statement. So
yes, thank you, sir.
All right.
Madam Chairman, I know that we're running a little long on time, but I wanted to identify to you, again, as I just described, the revised schedule for the ASAP project. And it's, again, aligning the ASAP project to the AKLNG feed decision. And that is, again, one quarter of 2016. If AKLNG were not to proceed, we would then look to our commercial interest to define what would be the optimal throughput for this project, and then enter into a redesign. With that redesign, we would then start the regulatory process with going through the Regulatory Commission of Alaska for a recourse tariff, and then go to an open season, and ultimately project sanction, with first gas now being in third quarter of 2024. So that's approximately 3 years later than our original time frame. But that's just due to the sequence of events and the regulatory process, as well as the execution process, to be able to advance this world-class project. Now, the work that we have included in our work packages was what we had also represented back to the Office of Management and Budget in regards to the Administrative Order 271. So that's the work that we've identified as the non-discretionary work for the ASAP project.
Okay.
Time is at 5:01. Okay.
It's fine. Keep
you're
going.
Fine?
Yep, this
okay.
is important.
You want to come up for a quick picture?
Sure.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, Dan Fowlsky, the AGDC. On the corporate focus near term, first quarter 16, the accelerate cooperation to maximize the state resources, eliminate duplication of the effort, align work efforts and routing, adjust our work plans. With the advent of the dual projects, and I hate to refer to it as a slowing down, it's more of an alignment. The other thing to remember is that you won't have a recourse tariff filing. You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't have an open season because the producers and AKLNG, no one's going to bid on it while they have another project in the works. So it's just one of those unfortunate time changes that occur. But at the end of the day, if successful, you end up with a much larger, much better project for the revenues of the state. And so that's kind of the golden ring that you're chasing on this. And I've said before, first quarter 2016 calendar year is kind of that date that we're looking at as to how the other projects are looking. For anyone's interest, I know that ExxonMobil announced yesterday $25 billion spend that they anticipate in British Columbia. They're moving forward with another project, which I like to see because it shows that there's some aggressiveness out there in world markets with all the ups and downs. But again, no guarantees, but there's certainly an interest by a corporation of that size, I think, in trying to move projects, move their product. And Alaskan represents a huge resource for them as well and the other companies. So I remain hopeful. I think the work going forward, we serve on all these committees, and I think it's been an absolutely honest effort, and everyone's really engaged, and we remain hopeful. It's not wishful thinking. There's a lot of money being spent right now to move that project. And so it's good news. It's continuing on to protect the state's interest in the Alaska LNG project, currently the LNG plant. That's where I work. I know we had Fritz Grusin online. I introduced him the other day. Fritz was 36 years with ConocoPhillips. He was a global lead for that firm on LNG, and he's been a valuable asset that we've added. And as we'd stated earlier, a lot of this work that we have to do is out of state only on some of the engineering, and we're doing our best to hire people locally. We were fortunate with Fritz that he wanted to move back to Alaska. He had two daughters here, so in the future, we would probably assign people outside rather than fly people back and forth all the time if they're going to be primarily involved in engineering work at either Calgary, Denver,
or Houston. We want to progress both initiatives to better inform the state's ultimate policy and investment decision makers and maintain the state's leverage and continue to build assets the state can bring to either project. I wanted to just touch back and remind, maybe for Senator Wilkowski's benefit and all of us, we were at plus or minus 30% on the original bid. So one of the things I was very pleased with is that in nominal terms, the new dollars we're looking at, we're at plus or minus 20%, but we're in 2014 dollars up 23%. So we were staying within a range, and there's just certain factors, as Mr. Haugen pointed out. Inflation is about $250 million a year on these projects, a mega project of that size. So there's just things, as time is not your friend necessarily, unless market conditions change to the point that it's working, moving in your direction. But I still feel comfortable. And another thing to point out, we had two benchmarks. Primary ones was that is can we beat or equal, but primary beat the price of imported LNG. And if you can't do that, kind of a fool's errand. And we believe we're still within that range. The other one though is that one, and I think the senator touched on it, which is an important one. We originally factored this project as Fairbanks using about 60 million feet of gas a day. We think now they're currently at about 20, 25. Not finding any fault with any, but it's just it changes that tariff model. But we're still within a range. But that's 250 million feet of gas that Alaskans use on the rail belt, and we know we want to expand that on a worse day. That means you have to sell 250 million feet of gas. I'm not sure that you're competitive at 500 million feet with the tariffs that we showed you on the board to sell that gas. And the only way you compensate for that is you increase volumes. And I'm not advocating you increase volumes, but it's simple math. And then there's a sweet spot out there where your costs of construction and the advanced work that you need to do to increase volume is less than or better than what it costs you to do that in terms of the amount of money that you can bring in on the enhanced tariffs or your volume increase because the tariff is done. I know we get off into the weeds, and I'm not sitting here advocating an increase, but we're at a point where I think it's still very viable, this project, as a fallback position, and also when you consider the amount of money that we've got available through assets that are benefiting the other project. We estimate in the range of anywhere from $20 to $25 million of work that has been done that benefits both projects. So I guess I'm here kind of just encouraging people to, I know these are tough budgetary times, but I think we're at a position where we're in the game. But we were happy to come forward today and show that the work that's been done is worthwhile. And if it wasn't, I'd be the first one to say that this just isn't working. But we want to maintain that leverage. I think one of the greatest things that ASAP brings to the table in negotiations with our friends on the other side, because we're business partners, is that leverage that shows that the state does have options. I'd also like to be clear, I don't know that if a large project fails, what the future would hold, but I think one of the things ASAP does is shows us that we do have an opportunity here if that were to occur, because the basic premise for starting the whole project in the first place was can we develop a resource for ourselves in the event that a large one doesn't go, because on the scary side and on that other side of the argument is, well, the cost of doing nothing gets pretty expensive too, unless we can't reinforce ourselves with some supply of energy. And we see what's going on not only in rural Alaska, but most recently Fairbanks has been tapped pretty hard. So anyway, we want to maintain our viability and readiness of the ASAP as an alternative. And anything else? All right. I'll be real quick here on the quantify in state gas demand. We want to collect and compile existing gas demand data. This is part of what was additionally what we need to focus on under SB Senate Bill 138 as to those other things that they want us to. So we're not just a pipeline company for just this one project. They want work done to show, like I've mentioned before, on the House Finance side a number of years ago when the HB4 was passing, there was a requirement and request to put in, and it was done in the bill, that we add propane to the mixture of gas. So we have about a 1.5% mixture of propane in the gas mixture, which is about 4,000 barrels a day of propane coming down. For the idea of make sure that we explore the options for possibly propane usage down the Richardson or down the Yukon. We're going to continue doing that work, research potential for new users and communities, model realistic demand scenarios and estimates, estimate usage and cost of service. We're looking at all these small communities and talking to them. What's going to be the best way when gas comes by is to get them that utility, that energy? Will it be a pipeline? Will it be trucking? Will it be, you know, to figure out those things? We're also charged with, under the AKLNG, which is a LNG project, the pipe runs, and then there's a flange that's put someplace, and it's our job to help determine where those flanges go. But that project has nothing to do with what happens on the outside past that flange. That's state responsibility and or local communities. And so we've been charged to make sure that we're doing work on that, is to help these communities. When that energy comes, how do they access it? And so we're working on those. So that's, again, identify that best delivery system mechanism. Plan, site, and develop in-state gas access points, which I just mentioned. Design that equipment required for offtake. Develop detailed cost estimates for the equipment. Coordinate with AEA, Alaska Energy Authority, ADA, Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority. I don't want the Senator Stedman to, and DNR, Department of Natural Resources. This acronym, I get confused every day. But regarding policy and infrastructure issues associated with increasing in-state gas access. Okay? Mm-hmm. So I'd like maybe to turn it over to Joe and Frank on just a real quick funding status so you know where we're at, Madam Chair and members, on the funding.
For the record, Madam Chair, Joe Dubler, the Alaska LNG project is we believe, fully funded through the pre-FEED stage. You can see from the table, $69.8 million was appropriated last year. We expect to expend all of that in through fiscal year. It'll be fiscal year 16. It'll be end of calendar year 15 and a part of next, the beginning of next year, but should be wrapped up before FY16 is over. So we'll have no funding requests for the AKLNG project at this time.
Madam Chairman, for the record, Frank Richards. I thought it was important for the public to recognize that there were two funds set up for AGDC to administer our projects for. What Joe just talked about was the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Project Fund for the advancement of the Alaska LNG project. And then the other project fund was for the In-State Natural Gas Project Fund for the ASAP project. So the legislature has appropriated approximately $419 million to AGDC for advancement of the ASAP project. Through fiscal year 14, we had expended approximately $120 million. And we are forecasting through the end of fiscal year 15 an additional $98 million. The majority of that was, again, to advance us with the work towards the Class 3 estimate and the engineering deliverables that we talked about earlier. And then proceeding forward into FY16 with the spend plan that I talked about earlier, an additional $51 million. What that would then leave at the end of fiscal year 16 is approximately a balance of $150 million that would be available for advancement of a natural gas pipeline project. And so that coincides with that 1Q of 2016 time frame. We wanted to just identify the balance that would be available, the work that we are deferring, so that we are then aligning those two projects, as Dan has just talked about.
Very good. Questions, committee members? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Knowledge that there's an audience out there, so I'm just asking a question to help. The governor included this project among several projects, the mega projects he put a freeze on. Can you describe the impact of that and how that affects the project? Is it de minimis? Is it significant? And thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly, Senator Stoltz, through the chair, Dan Fauske again for the record. The administrative order 271, if you read that carefully, we had to make a decision on discretionary versus non-discretionary spending. But we had already started this process months ago in reference to that spend plan, as we knew we were aligning to the AKLNG schedule, as to not get ahead of our partners, but to coincide with what they were doing. I think one of the things we should have touched on earlier was that we're at about, 98 or 99% alignment now on the route. So there's been a lot of work. Now I want to get to. And so when you go from 150, drop at 90 down to 60 million, but there also
In the administrative order, and our board, we had talks with the administration, and our board of directors held a public hearing on that and approved the spend plan going forward. Was that the order also said, and I think this is where some confusion has been, is it didn't tell you to cease or desist. It said to continue working until further notice. It was the language right in the administrative order. And so we've been working with OMB and the administration and others to. We've submitted our spend plan. We're waiting to hear some definitive answers back, but nowhere were we told to cease and desist. And so that was, I think, a little bit of the confusion that's out there. And that's not to say, we're going to work closely with them because in supporting what the governor, I think, is trying to do with tight dollars. But it's going to be interesting to see going forward. We feel the $60 million was certainly in compliance with, a $60 million spend dropped by $90 million was certainly in compliance. We certainly feel that we're at that non-discretionary fund position with the monies remaining to keep the project viable and moving forward. The irony for us, and you have a governor, and the governors are very powerful, as they should be, but you also have state law that's dictating what we're supposed to be doing, and you have a board of directors, and so you're trying to come up with that mix. No one's trying to defy the governor. That would never be anyone's intention, but you have state law as well directing what it is we're supposed to be doing. And so I think we've done a good job of getting in compliance. Senator Stoltz, to your question, without spending $150 million would have been fruitless in the sense that if you're going to try and stay on an AKLNG schedule, you'd be so far out ahead of that project, you wouldn't get the bids. There'd be no reason to file a recourse tariff. We would be wasting the people's money by doing that. So I think it's a good move. We're working with them. I'm assuming, I'm hoping that we're in compliance. We certainly vetted it very heavily the other day with the board and with some administration officials. So it hasn't been like we're operating in a void. If I may, I'd like to touch on one other issue, and that's back to what I think it was Senator Stedman said, and maybe a couple others. We went through an RFP process and selected Enbridge as our owner, builder, operator. And if we recall from the original HB4, it was always designed for an owner, builder, operator to come in. With the advent and the passage of SB 138 and the work, we've had lots of meetings with Enbridge, great company. We had other companies that were very interested and submitted bids and talked to us at great length. They had a great deal of interest in this project. We just felt, and we had a discussion with them, that we felt it was unfair. They were prepared to come into the corporation as what would take place and seconda their own employees and or start hiring the people that we on board if we were on that normal schedule that we'd originally depicted. But with the stretching out of the schedule, it was unfair to that corporation, and we certainly weren't going to request of them to spend a bunch of money knowing that we had to sit, wait and see what the schedule was going to do. But there has been a firm selected, and it goes back to the 70-30 where the equity would come from. And I can speak on, I think, not on their behalf, but certainly what they said. They were absolutely interested in this project and remain so to this day. I hope Senator Stoltz answered your question.
Totally sated for my interest right now.
All right. Any further questions from committee members? Gentlemen, thank you very much. This was a wonderful briefing. Our next meeting of this committee is January 23rd. That's Friday, 3:30 to 5 o'clock. We'll be hearing from Larry Pursley from the Federal Pipeline Office. The meeting is adjourned at 5:17 p.m.